Well, good morning. It's still good morning. And I figured out how to shut my music off. So we're going to bring Fred Malone up. Fred, are you there?
I'm with you.
All right. I found out how to shut the music off.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So we can go right in.
We learn something new every day.
I guess we do, even at 74 years old.
Yeah, why not?
Old dogs, you know, and new tricks.
Hey, a couple of quick things before we start with our sure. other subject. I did want to mention that the Marion County Historical Society is proceeding with our annual Lunch with the Presidents.
Oh,
on
good.
May the 27th.
My birthday. Course, very good.
We had to cancel, of course, last year because of COVID, but we're going to be able to social distance and do all the proper things, and hopefully people will have vaccinations. But you can get tickets for this event by stopping at the museum and any Monday through Friday. Just go on the State Street side and ring the bell, and they can accommodate you. Or you can pick them up when the museum opens on May the 5th.
Yep.
There in the when you come in to pay. If you don't want to tour the museum, you can still come in and buy a ticket for the luncheon.
Okay.
Don't know what the price is. I'm sorry.
That was my next question.
No, I didn't write it down. I just coordinate, get the thing set up, and get the presidents lined up. And the
well, girls, it's not $200, right?
No, the girls at the office take care of it along those lines. But this is kind of an abbreviated version of the Dinner with the Presidents that we do in November every right. year. We oftentimes do this for bus groups that want to come in out of town, or for people that don't want to travel after dark, you know, don't want to
sure.
do the evening one, the dinner in November, because it is dark when we do that one.
Yes, it would
this
be.
Is kind of a nice one to have at lunchtime. I only have four presidents speak, and we have it, we hold it over at Tri-Rivers at their in their auditorium, and it is a catered buffet-style lunch. Served by a group out of Upper Sandusky that's been doing our catering for our
And I know who they are, and they're very good.
Yeah. But this year I've got Benjamin Harrison, Martin Van Buren, Harry Truman, and George Washington are going to be my attendees.
You don't have Mr. Trump in there yet?
No, we only do dead presidents.
I know.
So he's going to have to part these shores before we even think about
all right.
that.
I got you.
Right. And I'm thinking that I'm not going to be in charge then. So.
Okay.
But anyway, if you're interested in tickets, you can stop at the museum. As I said, go to the State Street side, ring the bell, and they'll come out and take care of you. Or you can wait till the 5th of May and appear yourself in person there in the bookstore in the very in the main entrance of the
now,
museum.
Can you go in the bookstore without paying the admission
sure.
fee?
Sure. Yeah, okay. absolutely. If you want to stop in and get something from the bookstore,
okay.
it's right there in the as you come in the front door. You just go in and say, "Hey, I'm here to get a book, or I want to take a look at your gift shop, which is primarily
okay.
all books."
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that without paying an admission fee.
I can't imagine it's all books with you being involved.
Oh, no. Well, you know, that's a problem for me. I'm a hoarder of books, I guess you might call me. I've enjoyed books and reading my entire life. I collect vintage books. In fact, I just recently acquired a book published in 1858. Of poetry, and it was a book that I didn't even know existed. I didn't even know this woman existed. The book is called Proctor's Poets, Poems, and the woman's actual name was Mary Berwick, but she went with the pseudonym of Adelaide Proctor. And the reason she wrote in the pseudonym was because the company that she was trying to get her poems published through, one of their board members was Charles Dickens. And Charles Dickens happened to be a family friend.
He wasn't a bad writer himself.
No. happened to be a family friend of the Berwick family. And she didn't want him to see her name submitted because she didn't want any undue favoritism. So she submitted her poems
cool.
under a pseudonym. And so this book was published with an introduction by Charles Dickens after he, of course, discovered you know, who actually wrote the book. But she was born in 1825, died in 1864, and I'd never heard of her before. But doing some research on her, found that she was, during her time, that brief time that she was alive, I think she was only 39 years old when she died, or somewhere around
wow,
that.
Very young.
She was, in competition with people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was extremely popular during that time period. And the research I've been able to come up with states that she was actually more popular than what Ralph Waldo Emerson was.
My.
So this is unbelievable, especially for a woman poet.
Absolutely.
During that particular time frame. But this book is absolutely gorgeous. I just stumbled across it in a small antique shop. It's suede leather bound with gilded pages.
Well, you know, I'm kind of a collector of old books, and you know I don't read. But I have...
you like to look and feel of them.
I love to look at old books. Now, I have... my father left me the five-foot bookshelf, which is all the greatest books that were written, I don't know until what date, but, you know, it's beautiful.
What we call the classics.
Yeah, all the classics.
Right.
And it's beautiful. And I told myself when I was starting college that I was going to work my way through all of them. The only one I've ever gotten through was the one, books that have James Whitcomb Riley.
Who oh, is, sure, right. Another fabulous
I've read his,
poet.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, I read on the air Bear Story by
oh,
him.
Oh, sure, yeah,
and
right.
Great,
yeah, very
great
popular.
Story. Yeah. And
yeah.
So, but, you know, and I've gotten inspired now that you're talking about the Hundley. My eldest son has written five sci-fi books and published them.
Well, I'm sure he'll know Clive Cussler.
Oh, I bet he will.
Yeah.
But I'm going to talk to him because he loves that sort of thing. I'm going to talk to him about maybe doing something on the Hundley.
Oh, that'd be great. Sure,
I think
absolutely.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it wouldn't have to be, it could be fiction, but just... What went through those people's minds as they went down? Oh my goodness!
Well, of course there are several very prominent what we call historical fiction writers.
Yeah,
Newt Gingrich is one of them.
Is that right?
I didn't care for Newt Gingrich, but he's a very good author and he writes a lot of historical fiction on the Civil War.
I'll be darned.
And that's really what Clive Cussler was doing when he stumbled upon the Hundley. He wrote a book that involved, I think there's one out there that he wrote that involves the Hundley. That's how he got interested.
Well, I'm going to bring it up to my son because I think he would like the whole idea of writing about being trapped.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That.
Well, there's an author by the name of Eric Larson who is a very popular historical fiction writer. One of his most popular is Isaac Storm, about the hurricane that went through Texas back in 1900.
Uh-huh.
And another one is
Devil
in the White City, which is about the serial killer that was in existence in Chicago during the World's Fair there in 1893. So, yeah, there's a lot of great historical fiction out there. And, in fact... there's nothing wrong. I'm not a fiction reader normally, but I do read historical fiction because the only thing that's fiction in there is some of the made-up dialogue.
Yeah.
Obviously, they didn't have dialogue between people in those days, but all the facts and that type of thing, those are all based on real history that took place back in that time. So, I read that kind of stuff. I don't have a problem there. And, in fact, one of our most popular... historical fiction writer Alan Eckert. Have you ever heard that name?
Yes, I have heard
Alan
that name.
Eckert and his series with the Frontiersman and all that.
That's why I've heard it, yes.
Excellent, excellent, excellent books.
Well, you know, those fictional historical writers sometimes have to make up, you know, characters so that the real facts work together.
Sure, right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it requires a tremendous amount of research.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
Everything is not just made up.
I mean,
you've got to research what you're writing about if you're going to stay true to your cause.
Yeah.
A lot of great stuff like that. Your bookcase you were talking, is it a barrister's bookcase? Does it have the glass?
Yes. I've been told it's worth a lot of money.
if it's a barrister's bookcase with the glass, I have one. That was a family piece.
And,
it was handed down to me.
Each one lifts off the other, so
that's
it's
correct,
like
right.
four high.
Yep,
yeah.
That's what you have. You have a barrister's bookcase, right. Most of them were made of oak.
Yes, this one is,
but,
I believe.
In fact, we had a new building built last summer 10 by 16, 12 by 16 that to mainly house my books.
Cool. I love it.
My wife was getting kind of upset with me for
there was no room to sleep.
Stacks that I have around the house, you know. And of course, I have one separate bookcase beside my bed that's for my vintage collectible books, that like this one about Proctor that I just picked up recently. But this is an absolutely gorgeous book. This is, as I said, it's leather suede cover with gilded leaves, gilded pages, gold gilded pages. And to be in the condition it's in, I quite frankly, I think this was one of the copies that may have never been read, because it is almost in pristine condition.
Wow.
And when you can find something like that for $5,
oh my,
you've hit the jackpot.
Yeah.
So in doing some research, it's probably a $150 book in the antiquities market.
Well, my wife, I bought James Whitcomb Riley's 15-book collection.
Yes.
And my wife says, "You don't read. Why did you buy that?" Well, it's just so beautiful.
And it looks good in the bookcase.
Yes, it does. And it makes it look like I read.
Well, I've already started reading some poems in this book, and she was a lovely writer, I must admit. And of course, you can tell that she was probably part of the transcendentalism movement. Because it's in the right time frame, and the writings, you know, lend you to that feel. You know, you get that feel. So
that's kind of our era, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Maybe a little. Yeah, I think so.
I guess you might say that. Yeah.
Yeah.
For future reference, one of the things I want to talk about on your show sometime, and I'll just throw this out briefly, and
right,
people can be thinking about this, is the story of the Eastland. Do you know the story of the Eastland?
I do not.
The Eastland was a passenger ship that sunk while at the dock in Chicago.
Huh.
And it's one of the worst maritime disasters in the United States, and no one knows about it.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. I forget the exact death toll, but I was close to 1,000 people.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were all,
and it sank at the dock? And there are still 1,000 people?
At the dock, yeah.
How in the world could that
happen?
Very,
very interesting story.
Yeah.
And just kind of a teaser, they were mostly immigrants that were on that were living in Chicago, that were boarding the boat to do a one-day excursion to an island out in Lake Michigan.
There
it was kind of like a Cedar Point of its day.
Uh-huh.
And this tragedy occurred where the boat sank right in the harbor.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
My.
Very interesting story, though.
Kinda
and this
sad.
Occurred in the late 1800s.
Huh, interesting. Well,
we'll talk about that someday.
I almost drowned in Lake Michigan when I was racing the Chicago to Mackinac race one
really?
Time.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I was attached by a tether to the deck of the boat, and I got carried along for about, I don't know how many hundreds of feet, but I got myself back up on the boat.
A pretty fast swim.
Oh, yeah. There was no swimming involved. It was just drinking a lot of water.
Right, being drugged, yeah. Did you happen to by any chance see the news this morning that they were... the ABC News this morning, Good Morning America, had a segment on there about all the all the shore that's collapsing on Lake Michigan.
I have not seen that, but I know that's true. And my
yeah,
wife
they,
and I,
the people that have had cottages and homes,
yeah,
you know, up on these high banks, and the banks are literally caving in and falling away, and some
yes.
of the houses have already fallen in the
and
water.
On the eastern side of Lake Michigan, there are a lot of houses up on huge banks.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a whole, you know, there are some sandy beaches on that side, but not as many as are on the western side of the lake, southern side of the lake.
Actually, I think that's where they were this morning, because these were on real high banks, and
yeah,
they're working to try to secure the banks by putting in, looks like, big steel break walls or something to keep that soil from erosion. But it looked to me like some of those cliffs, or some of those banks that they were sitting on, were 50, 75 feet
oh,
up.
Oh, absolutely. And rock. They're solid rock, except where the water's washing them away underneath. Yeah.
Right. And according to this piece this morning, it's because the lake levels have increased so much.
Oh, my.
Over the years, that's creating the problem of washing all this soil out from underneath and kind of... it washes away, and eventually it just topples in.
Yeah. My wife and I looked at a house in northern Michigan, right up by Mackinac, where Mackinac City is, and they only, this was a long time ago, but they were offering it for $60,000, which was a very good price even then, but I mean, it was a tremendous price, but they pointed out to us that there was some erosion problem, but the house was going to be moved back, and it was moved back. We never bought the house because we just didn't have the money, but we did go and look at it several times, and they did move the house back about 60 feet. They put it on a big trailer and moved it back about 60 feet, so we felt comfortable that it would be there forever. We went up not too long ago. It's gone.
Yeah.
It's been washed away.
It's been washed away. That's a real issue for those people that have those homes up there. Even if they're just summer homes, it's a big issue. But if it's your year-round home, that's a big problem.
Yeah, that's
a really big problem. I don't know. Again, that just brings up this whole climate change issue that we're in right now, and I think people really need to take things seriously.
Yeah.
When you think about how many volcanoes are erupting around the world now, there's 28.
28
volcanoes currently erupting around the world
now, as we
speak.
And some of them haven't erupted in a long time. Yeah.
Well, and that's a big concern when you start talking about Yellowstone and whether people know it or not, that's a giant volcano that's sitting on.
And they say that if that ever blows again, it will wipe out much of civilization.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I'm doing a show right after we're off. You and I are off. Swap shop. I've got it's Earth Day, so I'm going to do a lot of things about Earth Day. So
right. Yeah. Well, the thing that concerns me, I mean, if it does erupt, it's as you say, it's going to wipe out. If it doesn't initially wipe out everyone out, the ash that it's going to create will cover the Earth.
Yes. Scary.
Something to think about. I don't know. But in the future, sometime we'll talk about the Eastland.
I'd like to.
I think that's a subject that's well worth talking
about. I'm going to write that down and look it up before we talk.
All right, because hardly anybody knows about the Eastland. And, we always think about the Titanic as being the worst maritime disaster, but it really wasn't.
Uh-huh.
There were a couple others that exceeded the Titanic.
Uh-huh.
I think the Titanic gets more publication because it was of when it occurred and where it occurred.
Yeah.
But, we've had some disasters right here in this country that...
You brought up a point that makes it obvious why this Eastland wasn't brought up. It was poor people.
Sure, right.
And
absolutely.
The people in the Titanic were filthy rich.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right.
All right. Yeah. Well, are we talking? We're talking about a book you're reading.
Well, actually, these are excerpts that I have collected over the years from the Reader's Digest of Forgotten History. And when I did Mike Wilson's show a couple of weeks ago, we talked along these same lines. I did some segments of this on his show, and I was talking about transportation.
It's a good thing we pay you a lot of money.
Yeah, right. Well, I love to do the research, and it's a lot of the things that I talk about are things I've already touched on years and years ago or read about when I studied more history than I do now. And I'm not sure I might do more now than I used to. I'm not sure. But we talked about transportation, railroads, and some of the things that involve railroads, early railroads. And
very timely with the infrastructure bill being brought up. So
absolutely. Well, not only that, but that there is some rumbling again in the State House about connecting Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati again by rail. I guess Amtrak is interested, and the government's even interested right now.
Yep.
So
that would be part of the infrastructure bill, probably.
They started talking about this whole thing probably 15 years ago, the state legislature did, and I thought we were going to get to that point
when
we had the 3C connection, but for some reason it got stalled, probably politics.
Yeah.
But it would be fantastic to be able to get on a train in Columbus and ride to Cleveland or Cincinnati, not have to fight the traffic and all that. I love to ride trains. Trains are one of my most enjoyable forms of transportation.
Well, they're kind of they kind of sway you to the rhythm.
Well, they do. And when I was a kid, my uncle lived in Cincinnati, and my mother would drive me from Logan down to Athens and put me on the train, and I'd ride the train from Athens to Cincinnati, and one of my favorite and most fond memories was eating in the dining car on the train on my way to Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And can you imagine, though, today, taking your 10-year-old kid to the train station, putting him on a train, and sending him to Cincinnati?
I cannot.
But this is the 50s, you know, things were different.
Yeah, and people didn't worry about that strange guy at the end of the
absolutely.
Now, I used to ride from, roughly Valparaiso, Indiana, into Chicago, most days on the South Shore, it was an electric train from the 30s. I mean, it was really old. It's new now, but it was quite interesting. We got to meet a lot. For 5 years, I rode with the same people, and we played bridge the same way. You know?
Yep.
It was fun.
Well, it's like the Interurban that used to run from Columbus to Bucyrus around here, and went right in front of right down Route 4, right in front of Lynch
School. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Now, we'll have to talk about that someday.
Yes, let's do that.
Well, today I want to talk a little bit about communication and technology from these forgotten history excerpts that I've taken out of Reader's Digest over the years. And the first one I want to talk about a little bit was our first broadcasters. You know, we when we think about broadcasters, immediately we think about radio and we think about television as being broadcasters. But really, if you really think about this, the clanging of a handbell and the cry of "Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye" were welcome sounds to many colonial towns.
Sure,
the signaling the arrival of the day's news. And I'm paraphrasing here from some of these articles. In an era when newspapers were rarities and few people owned clocks, citizens relied on the town crier to shout out both the latest news and the time of day. He also gave the time of day.
Now, did they have problems with some town criers were Fox News town criers and other town criers were MSNBC criers?
I don't think Annie did Tucker Carlson back in those days, at least I hope not. I think they were a little more truthful then, and I'm probably stepping somebody's toes. But I think they were honest men doing an honest job.
All right.
Making their rounds by day and also by night, the crier was entrusted with notices of things like town meetings, weddings, and even auctions. He was the one who told of delays in the departures of sailing ships, and also before the invention of the face on the milk bottle or jug, he talked about descriptions of children that were lost. Another thing that they did. In Salem, Massachusetts, for instance, it was the crier who called out to the residents when there was going to be a witch executed.
Oh, my.
And in Boston, the crier spread the news of even Paul Revere's ride.
Huh.
So they had a kind of a multitude of jobs. Now, in Massachusetts, the law guaranteed criers a payment of 2 pence for each notice that they aired. So they were getting paid for their job.
Yeah.
There, as elsewhere, the crier was a de facto town watchman. So he was also expected to slip in reminders of civic duties, like keeping livestock fenced in, for example.
Uh-huh.
And as long as his bell kept ringing, people knew that all was well.
Yeah.
Now, if he sounded a wooden rattle, however, people heard that as an alarm, a signal that they should rally, either fight a fire or protest maybe an unpopular decision from the crown, because we were still part of the British royalty in those days.
Huh.
So, really, that really was one of our first broadcasters, was that town crier.
Huh.
The peal of the town crier's handbell was one of the many jinglings, dings, and dongs filling the air in the days before car horns and ambulance sirens and fire engines were prevalent. All across America, bells were the medium for messages of many sorts in towns, both big and small. And I didn't really realize this, but bells be decked with wagons, sleighs, and streetcars to warn of their approach. They didn't have horns. They had to have some way of letting people know that they were behind them or getting ready to pass.
And they're still very popular in San Francisco, and if you hear a bell ringing behind you, you better get out of the way.
that's a streetcar coming up the road.
Yeah, that's right.
locomotives, too, were equipped with bells, not only for cautioning those ahead to clear the track, but also to inform ticket holders that the train was ready to pull out from the station. And on the farm, and this is true because I grew up on a farm, the clang of an iron bell beckoned the family to dinner.
Yeah, and that's still kind of a pop popular thing. A lot of people like to have a bell out on their front porch to ding for to bring the kids in. Now, you don't hear it very much, but they still have them there.
If you've ever been out to Lynn School, this is our, this is the Marion County Historical Society's restored one-room schoolhouse. We have a belfry with a big iron bell in it, and that was the way the teachers summoned the kids in the morning that school was about to start, because the one-room schoolhouses were placed roughly a mile apart in the early days, and they would service that one-mile area. And that bell rang loud enough that those kids could hear that in the morning, so that if they were doing chores and they heard so many clangs, they knew that they had 15 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it was, to get to school. Or if the kids were out to recess, they might be a half a mile, quarter mile away from the school playing in the woods, and the teacher could ring the bell knowing that it was time to bring them back in. So bells were extremely important.
It's kind of interesting. That kind of tells me I am part of history. My father, for about 2 or 3 years, my father asked me to ring the bell for church. And so I was the guy that rang the bell while we still had a bell, and then the bell broke off its mounting. But
absolutely. That was another primary reason for bells, to bring people to churches on Sundays. Yeah. Or if there were some big event that was taking place in town, if the bell started ringing continually, then you knew there was a problem.
You got
to town hall, or you got to the church, or you got to wherever the meeting place was to see what needed to be done. So, very, very important. But I do remember as a kid, you know, working in the barn or being down in the pasture or whatever, when I heard the bell ring, I knew it was time for lunch, or it was time for breakfast or dinner or whatever the case might be.
Now, does your mouth still water when you hear a bell ring?
Well, I oftentimes, I don't so much anymore, but I used to act as a school teacher out at the one-room schoolhouse, and so I enjoyed ringing the bell for people that were there visiting. And you're absolutely right. When I hear the bell ring, it does kind of make my mouth water a little bit.
There you go.
Especially for my grandmother's cooking.
There you go.
Country folk also tied bells of different tones on everything from cattle to turkeys, so they could identify their livestock by sound alone, and we did that. You know, we had certain cows in our herd, in our dairy herd, that we put bells on. They were kind of the ringleaders. Ringleaders, that's a little bit of a catch there.
Yeah, I got you.
To the herd. So we could tell by the sound of the bell which cow was moving and responding.
Huh. Interesting.
When the circus came to town, the parade might feature a wagon-mounted carillon. Remember those?
Yes, I do.
That clanged out hymns and popular tunes. And, of course, children would come running to the bells of the popcorn and the ice cream vendors as well. Other bells on the street could tell the arrival of the milkman, the cracker seller, the vegetable vendor, or the peddler with his wagon load of goods, and even the iceman.
Yeah.
The bell.
Yeah. You know, I actually do remember an iceman.
The iceman?
So do I,
because we lived on a farm.
Yeah, well, of course you do. Yeah.
And the iceman cometh.
Yes, he
and
does.
And supplied the ice blocks for the...
That and the milkman. I remember both of those guys.
And we were the milkman on our dairy.
Yeah, I bet you were.
We milked 110 head of Jerseys and had three trucks. My dad and his two brothers delivered milk, cream, cottage cheese. What else did we have? Butter that we delivered. So we had regular routes. So
I remember the old milk bottle that had the
creamer
rounded top.
It's
for the cream.
Top.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I have some of our bottles from our dairy, but I have not been able to acquire one of the cream top
milk
bottles, and I've been looking for about 50 years for one.
I remember
when we closed the dairy in 1960, we dug a big pit down in the bottoms, in our bottom field, and I remember tossing boxes full of bottles into that pit and cover.
Well, they're all broken right now, I'm sure.
But I do have some quarts and some pints and some little tiny cream bottles.
Was it called Malone's Dairy?
Was actually started out as W.E. Malone. That was my grandfather. He started the dairy in 1920. And then when the boys came along later on, he changed it to Malone and Sons.
Ah, okay.
So the bottles I have are Malone and Sons. But I do have one cap from W.E. Malone.
Ah, cool.
From when my grandfather started, but I don't have a bottle that just said W.E. Malone on it.
So all of our listeners, keep your eyes open, because Fred would like to get one of those,
I'm looking
for
a creamery bottle. For those of you that don't know, it's a regular milk bottle, and at the very top, it has an extra piece of glass that's about 2.5 inches high, And that's where the cream would separate and go to the top.
And it's kind of bulbous.
Yes, a little bit bulbous, correct.
Yeah.
Yep. But getting back to the bell, and one of the other things were factories. Factories had a bell that rang at 5 in the morning to wake their workers and again at 7 to call them to work.
And later a whistle, right?
And later a whistle, correct. Each town had a bell that rang to announce fires. Certain codes will let the firefighters know what neighborhood to go to.
Oh.
And then, of course, we talked about church bells.
Sure.
They also rang for births, funerals, weddings, deaths, holidays. And according to one authority in this article, the bell ringer should be able to sound the same instrument joyously, solemnly, alarmingly, and informingly by the handling of the rope alone.
I'll be darned. Well, I didn't have that skill when I used to.
You had to be pretty well versed in being able to pull that rope right to get different sounds out of it. I'm not quite sure how that works.
How do you get a sad sounding rope?
Yeah, that's kind of unusual.
Yeah.
Now, when we think of newsmen, of course, we think of Walter Cronkite, people like that. But do we ever think that Ben Franklin was actually a newsman?
Now that you mention it, he was, wasn't he?
He was. To publish a good newspaper, wrote Ben Franklin after buying the Pennsylvania Gazette in 1729, and I quote, "is not so easy an undertaking as many people imagine it to be."
Yeah.
By then, a veteran of his brother's paper, the New England Current, and active in Philadelphia as a busybody columnist for the American Weekly Mercury, Franklin was only 23 years old when he took over the Gazette and turned it into the most influential paper in the 13 colonies.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that is.
The self-educated Franklin was an editor, printer, writer, and tireless innovator all in one, applying his genius to commerce, politics, and society with equal diligence and wit. And for the amusement of his readers, he dreamed up a comic cast of correspondents with names like Anthony Afterwit and Alice Addertongue.
Interesting.
He was really quite a character.
He was.
If you've ever seen the play 1776 or the movie 1776, especially the movie, the character that plays Benjamin Franklin in that movie is absolute typecast. This guy is really fantastic. He was, of course, Franklin was a curmudgeon.
Yes.
He suffered from gout. And, of course, he was thought himself to be a real ladies' man. So a very interesting character in American history. If you read the biography, just Franklin, and I can't remember the author's name, but it's an excellent read, and it purveys Franklin as what he really was, a carouser. He startled his public with outrageous proposals, once suggesting that the colonies thank England for emptying its jails onto the shores by shipping a cargo of rattlesnakes home to the mother island. Franklin's view of freedom of the press was no less original. If all printers were determined not to print anything till they were sure it would offend nobody, he wrote, there would be very little printed.
Now
that's a statement that we could use today.
Sure is. Now, you know, I was lucky enough to grow up, I was basically a publisher of athletic literature for 18 years. That was part of my job as an assistant athletic director. And
Was that all with OU?
No, it was with OU and DePaul University
in
Chicago.
Okay.
And I was lucky enough to be in that industry as we went from typesetting to what we have now, the digital thing.
Yes.
And it was amazing to have to set type for your stuff.
Well, listen to this.
All
growing
right.
up in Logan, I, of course, was born in Southern Ohio, and when we sold the farm, we moved to Hocking County. That would have been in 61. And in Logan, we had a linotype company that built linotype machines.
You know, I think I recall that from, I recall hearing about that
from
one of my printer friends down
there. I don't
remember
what it was called, Logan Linotype or what it was called, but it was on 2nd Street in Logan, and I remember walking by there all the time and hearing the clink, 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 you know, those Linotype machines in there. And somewhere just recently, I know where it was. It was in last Sunday's Columbus Dispatch. One of the columnists just wrote an article about they were getting rid of an old linotype machine at the Columbus Dispatch and was looking for somebody to take it.
Yeah, well, there wouldn't be a whole lot of use for it right now except for as an antique.
Museum.
Yeah,
it would be a museum piece.
Yeah.
But, of course, there'd be a lot of scrap metal in it if someone wanted to scrap it out. But, you know, it's kind of a bygone era. And you being able to transfer from a linotype machine to a modern press That's quite a feat.
Yeah,
that's quite a feat. Absolutely.
All right.
So moving on with Franklin, one of his greatest journalistic innovations appeared in advertising. Now, until his time, ads were little more than jumbles of run-on listings.
Yeah.
But Franklin separated the list into single entries set off with the headlines and eye-catching product symbols, like a pair of spectacles, for example, called attention that this was an eye doctor or an optician. And by 1750, classified ads filled six pages of his newspaper. Can you imagine?
Wow.
And his paper probably didn't have more than 10 or 12 pages altogether.
Well, I wonder if he kind of led the way for people to put signs out in front of their businesses
with glasses.
Well, I'm thinking
so, yes, because that was very popular indeed. If you watch the pickers, you know, on the History Channel, they're always looking for those types of signs.
Absolutely.
A big tooth, you know, or a big pair of glasses, or, you know, a big boot for boot repair, whatever the case might be.
Yeah.
And I'm a great lover of the old Gunsmoke episodes from the 50s and early 60s. And in watching that show, you know, if you go up and down Front Street there in Dodge, there were boots hanging out, and the spectacles and all those things hanging out.
Yeah.
So that was the way people knew what the store was.
Yeah,
because most people couldn't read.
Yeah, that's right.
They couldn't read. Franklin's skill at capturing the public attention with print ended making very rich. At the age of 42, he was able to retire from the Gazette and turn his talent strictly to science and politics. But he got his start as a newsman.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah.
And I think I knew that, but yeah.
And of course, another one of the people that we think about being in the news was a guy by the name of Pulitzer.
Really?
Yeah.
I really don't know much of the background of Mr. Pulitzer.
I know
about his award.
I've got a little excerpt here, and I think we've got about, 7 minutes or so?
Yeah.
We may be able to get a couple more of these covered. Signs lined the walls of the New York World City Room, and it said, accuracy, terseness, accuracy. Even when the boss was away, he cabled reminders to the paper staff constantly. Get the facts. Read one long-distance critique. A bank robber described as short. What's short? 4 feet, 5 feet? The exact. He wanted the exact dimensions. Other things that spilled out regularly from the lips of publisher Joseph Pulitzer, who combined high-mindedness and practicality. As a result, he not only elevated the standards of journalism, but also launched two papers, and I didn't realize this, the New York World and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, both of which became immensely influential in the 1860s.
Quite far apart, too.
Yes. He was actually born in Hungary. He immigrated to America in 1864 as a 17-year-old speaking very little English. Although frail and suffering from poor eyesight, he had served in the Union Army, and by 1878 done a stint as a reporter for the St. Louis German language newspaper. He also became an American citizen, a lawyer, an alumnus of the Missouri legislature, and a very fierce Democrat. And we should know that. You and I should know
that. Yeah, we should know that, yes.
That same year, he decided on journalism as a career. He bought paper that had gone bankrupt, the St. Louis Dispatch, for $2,500.
Wow.
And merged it with the failing St. Louis Evening Post and doubled their circulation with a mix of reformist politics and pulp news.
Huh.
5 years later,
what's pulp news?
He was into pulp news.
What is pulp news?
Well, I'm assuming that what they're referring to in pulp news is a sensationalist.
Yes, that's what I assumed that was.
That'd be my guess.
Yeah. Okay.
5 years later, while en route to Europe, he bought the New York City's Troubled World, and again worked a similar miracle there, appealing to workers with a pledge that the newspaper would fight all public evils in its battle for the people. Pulitzer also knew how to build circulation, offering the first comic page and hiring a girl reporter by the name of Nellie Bly.
Remember
Nellie Bly?
Sure.
Although the reputation of the World sank as the paper took a side trip into sensationalism in the 1890s, Pulitzer was able to restore its standards and continued to run the paper until he died in 1911.
Was he called a communist at any point?
You know, I'm not sure. It wasn't in the article that I pulled out of the Reader's Digest, but He may have been called a communist or a socialist. I don't know.
It wouldn't surprise me just listening to what you're saying there.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So since we mentioned Nellie Bly,
let's
talk about Nellie
Bly. Let's do it.
The journalist called it Nellie Bly. What girls are good for ran a headline in the Pittsburgh Dispatch on January the 14th, 1885. Boy, now can you imagine seeing that headline today?
No.
And the condescending tone of the article beneath it caused teenager Elizabeth Cochran to fire off a letter demanding equal pay for equal work.
Oh, my God. What year was this?
1885.
Wow, she was a little ahead of her time.
Apparently impressed, the editor printed her note, sent her a $5 bill as paid, and offer her a job.
Oh, fantastic. $5 was a lot of money back then, I would assume.
It was. Now remember the name, Elizabeth Cochran.
Okay.
Under the pen name of Nellie Bly, a character in a Stephen Foster song, the high-minded girl soon was writing exposés of the exploitation of women who worked in local factories. So Nellie Bly's real name was Elizabeth Cochran, and she got started by being upset by the headline, What Girls Are Good For.
I just wrote that down so I could tell my wife.
Circulation soared, but advertisers complained. That sounds a little familiar,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, it does indeed.
So when Bly found herself relegated to the society pages, she promptly left for Mexico. She was a forerunner in women's publishing. She spent 6 months south of the border writing about official corruption until the government asked her to leave.
Well, it was nice that they asked.
Didn't just throw her out. Unbound, she went back to New York and began working for Joseph Pulitzer's World newspaper. Sweatshops, bribery in the state legislature, corruption in city hospitals, mashers in Central Park,
yeesh,
and marriage brokers all felt the sting of Nellie Bly's pen.
Was she would you call her a muckraker?
I would say she probably was considered a muckraker.
Yeah.
A definite troublemaker.
Yes, definitely.
In 1889, she took a busman's holiday and beat the imaginary, and I did not know this, and beat the imaginary 80-day round-the-world travel time of the fictional Phineas Fogg. Remember that?
Yes.
Phineas Fogg in Round the World in 80
Absolutely.
Days?
Absolutely.
Her editor had said he'd prefer to assign that story to a man, but by threatening to go to a rival paper, Bly won his support. She was a tough girl.
She was.
Off she went, writing steamships, trains, burros, sampans, and rickshaws to ride back home in just 72 days, 6 hours, and 11 minutes.
Oh, my. That's fantastic.
Beat the 80 days.
That's fantastic.
Now one of the most famous journalists in the country, Bly won her own byline column in the world.
Huh. Now, I think I've seen a movie about her, I believe.
Yeah, I think there was.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there was.
Yeah.
In 1895, married to a Brooklyn industrialist, sidelined her career, however. But she came back to the beat in 1919, writing a column for the New York Evening Journal until her death in 1922. Her campaign for equality had been so successful that her obituary described her not as a woman reporter, but simply as America's best reporter.
Oh, my goodness.
And we'll end with that.
That was way ahead of its time.
It was.
To say
way,
that.
Way, way ahead of
yeah,
its time.
Yeah.
Way
well,
ahead
we're,
of time.
We're down to about 40 seconds. So.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed today.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
Unfortunately, with me calling in, we don't get the ability for people to call in and ask questions.
Yeah.
But maybe one of these days I can move back into the
studio.
Yeah,
we're getting close, maybe. Yeah, well, I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you take care of yourself.
All right.
Stay healthy. And
I'll be back on the third Thursday of next month.
The third Thursday of next month. All right. Now, I get confused, so I will have to write that down. All right, well, thanks a lot, Fred Malone with the Marion Historical Society. Have a great day, Fred.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. What a great show. All right. We'll talk to you in
You're
about 15.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 LP, Marion, Ohio, the place to talk.